Welcome back to the UFO Rabbit Hole podcast. I'm your host, Kelly Chase. I've got a truly remarkable interview to share with you guys today, but before we dive in, I wanted to take a second to let you know about some exciting things that are coming up for the podcast in the coming weeks. First of all, as I'm sure most of you are aware at this point, I will be co-hosting and also speaking at the Ohio UFO Heritage Conference that is being held at the historic Hope Hotel at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base on May 5th and May 6th. We'll have speakers including Dr. Diana Walsh-Pasulka, Bryce Zabel, Dr. Michael Masters, Micah Hanks, Darren King, aka Exo Academian, J. Christopher King, Phil Ford, and J.F. Martell from the Weird Studies podcast and yours truly. We'll also be doing a private screening of James Fox's Moment of Contact with a Q&A with the man himself to follow. I couldn't be more excited about this lineup of speakers, and I'm absolutely humbled at the opportunity to be doing this literally at the gates of Wright-Patterson Air Force Base for reasons that we'll discuss more deeply in just a second. Tickets are on sale at ufoheritage.com. But first, I wanted to let you guys know about the content that you can expect to see over the next few weeks. I know that everyone is eagerly awaiting episode 20, which is part 2 in the Waking Up Inside the Cave series. This next episode will focus on simulation theory, the zoo hypothesis, Christian Gnosticism, Jacques Vallée's control mechanism, and more, as we explore the possibility that we might be living in something like the Matrix. As you can imagine, it's a beast to write, but I'm hoping to get that to you guys by the end of April. In the meantime, I have some other great episodes planned, which is something that will be happening a lot more often in between regular episodes. So going forward, regular episodes will continue to be numbered EP1, EP2, etc. Those episodes are serialized and are best enjoyed in order. However, I want to start making room for other kinds of content as well, so that I can bring you guys the most interesting and up-to-date information that I can. When I started this podcast around 18 months ago, public disclosure was moving at a slow crawl. The government had said nothing except basically that there were unidentified objects in our skies of unknown origin doing some things that we couldn't explain. It was clear that things were happening behind the scenes, but the progress was slow. All that has changed in recent months. Legislation has been passed in an effort to both facilitate and mandate greater transparency around UAPs. A new office was created within the Pentagon. And last May, we saw the first congressional UFO hearings in 50 years. But in 2023, things seem to be moving with even more urgency. The bizarre nature of the incidents surrounding unidentified objects being shot down over U.S. and Canadian airspace in February, and the even more bizarre and checkered response from the government to these events, seems to many insiders to be evidence of a shifting of the center of power with regard to control of the UFO narrative. Something is changing, a giant is stirring, and word is that Congress is pissed and will be demanding new UFO hearings potentially as soon as April in both the Senate and the House. Now, please don't hear what I'm saying to mean that we're just mere months away from the president getting on TV and confirming that we have reverse-engineered craft and bodies. It's impossible for anyone to say how, when, or even if meaningful disclosure will occur. But what's going on right now is at the very least historic. So moving forward, I'll be doing periodic episodes focused on current events surrounding UFO disclosure, and I'll be kicking that off a week from today when I'll drop an episode with Chris Sharp of the Liberation Times to talk about the potential upcoming UFO hearings. If you aren't familiar with Chris Sharp, I really can't recommend his work enough. Chris is the founder and editor-in-chief of the Liberation Times. And over the last 18 months, he has consistently beaten the major media outlets to the punch on virtually every major story around UFO disclosure and has continually delivered the kind of nuanced, in-depth investigative journalism that is so rare when it comes to this topic. It would be hard to find a better source to talk to about what's going on in Washington right now, and I cannot wait to get him on the show. And that episode will come out a week from today, April 6th. Patrons, as always, will get it a little early on April 4th. And then, the following week on April 13th, I have something truly special for you guys. Dr. Diana Walsh-Pasulka will be joining us on the podcast once again, but this time, she'll be sitting in the interviewer's chair as we speak with Dr. Ea Whiteley. You may not have heard of Dr. Whiteley before, but I can confidently say that she is one of the most fascinating people on the planet. and it is an absolute honor to be able to bring this conversation to you all. Dr. Ea Whiteley is a space psychologist who has designed training programs for astronauts that help them prepare for and adapt to the rigors of space travel. A pilot and adventurer herself with a love for scuba and skydiving, Ea is passionate about exploring extreme states of human experience and human potential. Her unique perspective and skill set has led her to spearheading broad innovations in the space and aviation industries, and she also has a particular interest in developing means of communication with non-human entities. Dr. Ea Whiteley is truly one of those rare individuals who has the kind of mind that can both see and invent the future. The scope and impact of her work is honestly dizzying. She will be featured in Dr. Pasulka's upcoming book, Encounters, Experiences with Non-Human Intelligences, which is due out in November of this year. And it is such a privilege to have Diana join us for this conversation. Honestly, these are the moments where I pinch myself that I even get to do this work. And I've got a great episode for you all today as well. In this episode, I had the pleasure of sitting down with Thomas J. Carey, who co-authored the book UFO Secrets Inside Wright-Patterson, Eyewitness Accounts from the Real Area 51, alongside Donald R. Schmidt. For over 30 years, Carey and Schmidt dedicated themselves to investigating the Roswell incident, doing exhaustive research and interviewing hundreds of first and secondhand witnesses to the events of that day in 1947 in the New Mexican desert, and what happened to the alleged materials and alien bodies that were reported there. They have written 12 books on the subject, including the book we'll be discussing today, which explores the profound role that Wright-Patterson Air Force Base played in both housing and investigating these materials. Now, I will tell you that I believe, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that something truly anomalous and non-human crashed in the desert in Roswell, New Mexico in July of 1947, and that the government covered it up. But as always, I don't expect you to take my word for it, and I'd encourage you not to. The proof for the second half of that statement, that the government covered up what happened at Roswell, is self-evident in the fact that they have changed their official story no fewer than 4 times in the intervening years. But as for the first half of that statement, that something truly anomalous and non-human crashed in the desert at Roswell, that's a much more complicated and in-depth conversation than we have time to go into today. However, I will link to Tom Carey and Don Schmidt's other work on the topic, as well as other well-respected resources so that you can check those out if you want to learn more. And also, spoiler alert, in this episode, Tom will share what he believes are the 2 clear smoking gun pieces of evidence that a non-human craft crashed at Roswell, both of which you will be able to fact check and chase down on your own to draw your own conclusions. And as always, all the links can be found in the episode brief. But the focus of our conversation today will be on Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. As a lifelong Ohioan who is lucky enough to be given the opportunity to help organize a conference at the gates of this historic site, I have found myself ever more intrigued by the mysteries that it presents. Built on the site of Wilbur Wright Field, where the Wright brothers conducted their first early experiments in human flight, Wright-Patterson has grown and evolved over the years, with each new chapter of our journey to the stars leaving an indelible footprint on this flat, open plain just outside of Dayton, Ohio. Today, sprawling over nearly 13 square miles, Wright-Patterson stands not just as a multi-billion-dollar monument to the highs of human achievement, but to the depths of our most profound secrets as well, with most of the base hiding like a labyrinth deep underground. As I prepared for this episode, my mind kept returning to the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, where for millennia, the Abrahamic religions have built and rebuilt again and again on the same sacred land, leaving layers upon layers of history. It was the site of the Holy of Holies, the inner sanctuary of the temple where God's presence was said to appear. Only the high priest was allowed to enter this space, and only one day each year. It also called to mind the Giza Plateau and the stories of secret chambers containing lost knowledge hidden deep underground. Are these just fanciful daydreams? In one sense, the answer is clearly yes, of course they are. The purpose of the temple was religious, the purpose of Wright-Pat is military, and the purpose of the pyramids and the Sphinx of the Giza Plateau are still largely unknown. There's never been a shred of evidence to support the notion that they were for burial purposes, and so it's hard to know at this point what they were for. Between these differences and the vast divides of culture, context, and time that divide them, it could easily be argued that such comparisons can only ever be superficial at best. And yet, I'm going to persist for just a moment in making that comparison. Because as we contemplate the very real evidence that Wright-Patterson was the repository for non-human technology and bodies after the Roswell crash, I can't help wondering if what we're seeing at all three of these sites might be a response to a very particular kind of stimulus. The secrets at the heart of our contact with the divine, numinous, and otherworldly are something that we tend to hide away, usually deep underground or tucked away behind high walls, out of view and inaccessible. Only a select few are given the secrets of the inner chambers and what they contain. Why do we do that? Is it that secrets themselves contain a kind of power? Is it all just smoke and mirrors in order to pad black budgets in the pockets of a select few? Or could it be that there's something about the nature of our contact with non-human intelligences that demands to be hidden? Perhaps there is a truth that is too terrible to share, or perhaps we're just not ready. Whatever the answers to these questions, we all owe an enormous debt of gratitude to researchers like Thomas Carey and Donald Schmidt, who dedicated decades of their lives to recovering and documenting these lost histories. It is through the tireless and largely thankless efforts of people like them that we have the hope of one day piecing the story back together, and in doing so, becoming reacquainted with the truth of who we are and our place in the cosmos. So let's dive into it. My guest, Thomas J. Carey, received a bachelor's in business administration from Temple University, a master's in anthropology from California State University, Sacramento, and a PhD in anthropology from the University of Toronto. An Air Force veteran who held a top secret crypto clearance, Tom is now a retired Philadelphia area businessman. He has been a MUFON State Section Director for Southeastern Pennsylvania from 1986 to 1991, a special investigator for the J. Allen Hynek Center for UFO Studies from 1991 to 2001, and a member of their board of directors from 1998 to 2001. Tom began investigating aspects of the Roswell incident in 1991 for the Roswell investigative team of Kevin Randall and Don Schmidt, and since 1998 has teamed exclusively with Don Schmidt to continue a proactive investigation of the case. You can find his full bio and list of authored books in the episode brief. Without any further ado, here is my guest, Thomas J. Carey. Tom, thank you so much for joining me today. I just got done reading your incredible book about Wright-Patterson, and I'm so excited to talk to you. Welcome to the show.
My pleasure, Kelly. And it's a fine day today, and it's nice to meet you.
It's wonderful to meet you, too. So I just want to dive in because there's so much in this book. What was really humbling to see was just how much hard work and shoe leather went into piecing together these lost histories that have been intentionally hidden and suppressed. And I know that that's something that you've dealt with a lot in your work. So can you talk about, like, what is even the process of beginning to write a book like this where so many of the witnesses have been maybe scared or intimidated out of even wanting to tell their stories, or even wanting to be found?
Well, Kelly, you have people today. You can see them on, several channels. They think they're, I'm going to solve this Roswell case in a week. Well, I've been on the case since 1991, active. And you've heard of the old term gumshoe, the old gumshoe investigator. And that's what this case required. It was so complex and variegated, and we were chasing the Undertaker. The Undertaker was racing with us to so we could find all of the witnesses that we could find before they passed away. And the Undertaker ultimately won, but not before we solved the case of over 30 years of work, interviewing people, going to the various crash sites. And that's what this case required. I didn't work on any other case other than this one, and neither did my co-author, Donald Schmidt. We worked on this case alone. Of course, we heard of other cases, but our active investigation of a proactive gumshoe nature, knocking on doors, making phone calls, having doors slammed in our face, phones hung up on us, That's what this case required. And as a result, we have located and interviewed over 600 first and secondhand witnesses. That's what makes this case different than any other UFO case, is the number are the number of witnesses that we got on the record. And also what makes this case different is that we have not just the light in the sky, although, you know, something like the Phoenix lights, that's a good case, but it's lights in the sky, right? And that's all, and maybe a viewing of a triangular crypt, but there's nothing left other than that. This case involves an alleged crashed flying saucer or disc or UFO, physical evidence, with occupants. Back in 1947, they didn't call them aliens. They called them little fellas or little people, but not aliens. They didn't use that term. They just said little people. There were little people involved. And so you have physical evidence. You have biological evidence. You have intimidation and threats of death if people talk, and a huge government cover-up. So you have all this wrapped up in one case, and that's why it took us over 30 years to put all of this together. And we believe we've solved the case. The only thing we're missing, Kelly, is a piece of physical evidence that we can go on television and say, okay, folks, look at this. We don't have to send it away to a lab that you'll never hear from again. Here's what this piece of evidence looks like. And mostly I'm talking about what they call the memory medal. If you read the book, you know what I'm talking about. The memory medal that you could fold up like this in your hand, open it up, and it would just sort of float there, unfurl itself, and just float there down lazily. And you couldn't cut it, scratch it, or permanently deform it in any way. It was very thin, looked like thin tin foil from a piece of chewing gum, you know, if you eat a little foil. I won't say smoke because people don't smoke anymore. But that's what it looked like, and it was indestructible. So that's what this case required. I mean, how else could something occupy your interest for so long if it wasn't, number one, interesting, number two, a mystery, which it was a mystery, and number three, every time we got a new witness, boom, it spurred us on to keep going. And we've co-authored together, Donald Schmidt and myself, 12 books on the Roswell case. The one we're talking about today is the UFO Secrets at Wright-Patterson, where all of this stuff originally went.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for all of your hard work, because all of this could have been lost, right? All of this amazing history.
I started out, my hair was brown. My hair was brown when I started this.
Yes, and it was you and just a handful of other researchers who just wouldn't let it go. And if it weren't for you, we wouldn't have this information. So thank you so much for doing that. Going back to the history of Wright-Patterson before we get to the more fun stuff about what might be hidden there. But Wright-Patterson Air Force Base was built on the spot where the Wright brothers took their first steps towards flight. Can you talk a little bit about the early history of the base, like up through World War II, and how it shaped Wright-Patt into being the most natural and logical place for the Roswell crash materials to be taken?
Wright-Patterson, to go through the early history of it, it will give you a headache.
We can take a high level view.
Yes, too many name changes for the two bases. It started out, you know, the Wright brothers were in the bicycle business. They manufactured and repaired bicycles, and they bought this level plane. I don't mean like an airplane. I mean a level plane near Dayton, Ohio. I forget what it was originally called. There were so many different name changes. Patterson Field. I'm not even going to try to remember them. But it wound up that there were two bases there. One right field in honor of, it was either Orville or Wilbur Wright. I don't know which one it was, but one of the Wright brothers, right field and Patterson Field. And so along comes World War One, and the government just took over these fields because the airplanes, these newfangled gadgets called airplanes, they needed a place to land and take off and test and all that. So the government took over Wright Field and Patterson Field. And so after the war is over, they said, oh, we really like this. So they kept them, but they still called it Wright Field and Patterson Field. Along comes World War II, and lo and behold, one of the key things that the military wanted to do is they wanted to get a hold of Axis, either German or Japanese aircraft, to capture them, to see what made them go, what made them fly, and how the United States could build something that would defeat each of them in battle. And so they would capture these, and they ultimately wound up at Wright Field in the back engine. They call it back engineering, re-engineering, where they would take them apart, you know, nuts and bolts and all the things, take them apart, see what made them tick, put them back together and test them flying. And so Wright Field is already in the back engineering business in World War II. And so along the war is over, and who is our new adversary? The Soviet Union. So that's where the MiG-15s wound up, was at Wright Field again for back engineering, because, you know, and when we went to Korea, we had just started manufacturing jet engines, and our early jets could not compete with the MiG-15, the Russian plane, because it had swept wings, you know. So we captured one, made it, you know, took it apart, and we started building our own jets with swept wings. And I think it was, what was the Lockheed Shooting Star and the Sabre jet, the North American Sabre jet, was a result of that. So along comes, you know, the Korean armistice is over, and all of a sudden, actually from World War II, these funny things were in the sky. We started seeing these funny globes and disc-shaped objects and what have you, beginning in 1947 en masse. And we started seeing, it was like a lot of them, especially in New Mexico, where all of our atomic research was going on. So when one, I still use the term allegedly, crashed in New Mexico in 1947, well, where else would you take it to back engineer it? Wright Field. They took it to Wright Field to back engineer the wreckage, to see what was made of and all of that stuff. It was the natural place to go. Also, the biological material, I say aliens now, they went to Wright Field as well, because that's where we had our advanced biomedical laboratories and hospital. So that's where everything went, to Wright Field. And it's still at this point, 1947, it's still Wright Field and Patterson Field. In September of 1947, there was the Defense Act, where Wright Field and Patterson Field merged to become Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. They did away with the name Field in favor of Air Force Base. So it became Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and it's been that way ever since. But in 47, and for many years thereafter, it was still the most important base, Air Force Base, in our inventory. It had the so-called Foreign Technology Division. That went through name changes as well. It'll get you, make your head spin. So I always refer to it as FTD, Foreign Technology Division. That's where all of the foreign stuff went. That was physical evidence. Physical stuff went to the FTD or foreign technology at Wright Field. And so that's where the Roswell wreckage went. That's where the bodies went. And they stayed there. You know, they were analyzed and back engineered the memory metal. And the bodies were dissected. The bodies were actually loaned around to various hospitals, military hospitals over the years. But the material stayed there until about the early 90s, 1982, 83, 84. Then it went to Area 51 in Nevada. But originally, and for many years, the real Area 51 was Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. I know whenever I give a lecture, I'll ask the audience, how many of you have heard of Area 51? All the hands go up. All the hands go up. Well, how many of you have heard of Wright-Patterson Air Force Base? Maybe one or two hands go up. So they don't know about that, but that was the first Area 51 where all of this alien stuff, let's call it, went. So that's a short history. That's as short a history as I can give, Kelly.
That's wonderful. Thank you. And for anyone, I don't want to get too far down the proving Roswell rabbit hole, because I feel like that could be its own, you know, we could make a whole podcast just about that. But for anyone who's listening, you've done extensive research on this topic. If somebody's skeptical about the idea that something truly anomalous crashed at Roswell, where would you direct them to look? Maybe to one of your books, or where would you send people who are curious?
Well, you're exactly right. Everybody, including doctors and lawyers. I mean, we've heard from every level of society. Once they read one of our books, they say, "You've convinced me." We've had lawyers tell us, if we ever went to took the Air Force or the military to court over this case, we would win hands down, slam dunk, because the military, the Air Force, the defense, they have no answer for us. They have no answer for us other than to remain silent, because they can't combat the facts that we have put together over the years, all the witnesses, the locations, and everything that went on, the back engineering, stuff like that. They have no answer for it. So if you remember, was it last year that they held this conference or in the House of Representatives, where they two defense, one was from the Defense Department, the other was from the Navy, both intelligence people. They cut off their investigation. The baseline started in 2004. That was the Nimitz tic-tac case. They didn't go beyond. Hey, wait a minute, folks. The best cases occurred before 2004. So what happened was they now have been instructed by Congress to go back. Initially, it was to 1947. And we all know what happened in 1947, don't we? The Roswell case. Well, they're going back to 1945 is going to be their baseline, which is actually before what I call the modern age of UFOs, when it began in 47. But somebody talked them into going back to 1945, but originally they just wanted to go back to 1947, which was okay because it covers the Roswell case, which is the one they don't want to talk about, because you can't, there's no way you can get around it. And so I'm anxious to see. The next report, Kelly, is due out, I believe, in June of this year, June 25th or somewhere around there. I'm anxious to see what, if anything, they have to say about Roswell, because they just can't compete with the 30 years. You know, I spent 30-plus years. Don Schmidt spent 30-plus years on the case. We developed from every point in the case, from the crash to the delivery at Wright-Patterson, we have witnesses all along the trajectory. All along the trajectory. We have them on the record. Unfortunately, they're all dead now. That's one of the problems of future research, is that all of the first hand witnesses that we know of are gone. So, but we have more than enough to really knock this thing out of the park.
Wow. And throughout your book, there were several references to potentially two or three other crashes that were alleged to have happened in just the few years right after Roswell. What do you make of those stories and those reports?
Kelly, I've heard those stories too. The one crash I'm talking about is this Cape Girardeau in Missouri, 1941. The problem with that case is that there's only one witness. There's only one witness. To a case of that magnitude, you have to have more than just one witness who's long dead. And the other one is, I believe, a hoax. It's the 1945 case that allegedly occurred in San Antonio, New Mexico. Not San Antonio, Texas, but San Antonio, New Mexico. And the witness went to Stanton Friedman, fellow Roswell investigator, the original Roswell investigator, who unfortunately passed away three years ago. This witness, I won't name him because I don't want to get in trouble. he came to a stand. He says, I don't want any part of this case. So he came to me. And so I'm listening to this story and I'm thinking, my goodness, this is only one witness he's claimed that it had a crash in 1945 with all these other witnesses, but none of whom he could name. And finally, he said to me, how can I make money off of this case? And that was the clincher for me that this was a phony case, because he wanted to know how he could make money on this case. The other thing was, I said, do you have any physical evidence? Do you have any photos? Oh, I have a photo. I have a photo. He sent me a photo, Kelly. It looked like, now you know what a swivel chair, the base, that what it stands on is a something like this, and the legs go out, a swivel chair. It looked like the base of a swivel chair that somebody had painted silver. And I said, I'm sorry, yeah. this doesn't do it. And further investigation of it turned out to be a housing to a windmill, one of the flanges on a windmill, the housing on it that somebody had painted silver. And that's the other case. That's a hoax. The Cape Girardeau case, I don't call it a hoax, but it there's not enough there. It's only one witness, and that doesn't do it for me, you know? So
yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm sure that you're...
Those are the other two.
Well, I'm sure you're wading through that kind of stuff all the time, you know, here.
Yes.
Stories that either you can't confirm or stories that you think are a hoax until you find, you know.
Yes. Well, every time we get a case, and right now I have to tell you that that's few and far between these days because everybody's dead. Every time we get a case that involves either wreckage, physical wreckage, or bodies, that goes right to the top of our list, and we drop everything and investigate that to see where it leads, because those are the two most important things lacking in our evidence, is a piece of physical evidence that we can show to call a press conference live and not have to send it away to some laboratory that you'll never hear from it again. I am told, though, by a associate of mine, who's an excellent investigator. I won't give his name because I don't know if he wants me to use his name or not, but he's been on the case working with us for the last somewhere between 10 and 15 years. He was told by a doctor who was there that there are tissue samples at Walter Reed Hospital in Washington, D.C., of you know, one of the Roswell aliens or more, but he said a reputable source told him that tissue samples from one or more of the Roswell bodies is still at Walter Reed in Washington, D.C., which makes sense because that was a, you know, Walter Reed Hospital. And we have another witness on his deathbed. I'm going to be giving a talk in May of deathbed confessions that were related to Roswell. And on his deathbed, he was a former head of FTD, Foreign Technology Division at Wright-Patterson. His name was George Weinbrenner, Colonel. On his deathbed, he said, "We have 5 alien bodies in Utah." Well, that would be Area 52, Dugway. And it makes sense, because when things got too hot at Area 51 in Nevada, they moved it all to Area 52 in Utah, and that would be the Dugway Proving Grounds, very similar to Area 51. So that things like that is what we're told, that 5 of them, and there were 5 of them at Roswell, wound up at first it was Wright-Patterson, but ultimately they wound up at Area 52, Dugway in Utah, which is was a military proving ground during World War II, and a lot of secret stuff going on there as we speak.
Wow, that's fascinating. So a chapter of the book that I really appreciated was the one about Hangar 18.
Oh, yeah.
Because there's been a ton of debate over the years about whether or not it even exists. Can you briefly explain for listeners, first of all, why Hangar 18 is significant, but also what you found out about its actual existence and location?
Yes, thank you, because that's an easy, for me, that's a softball question. Kelly, Hangar 18, and I put that in quotation marks, was the, at Wright-Patterson, there's something called the Building 18 Complex. It's a conglomerate of 7 or 8 buildings, starting with Building 18, then Building 18A through 18G or GHI, some one of those things. But in that complex, there's only one hangar, and it's Hangar 23, okay? It's Hangar 23, and why they don't call it Hangar 18, I just admit it, folks, just admit it. But they have given it the name Hangar 23. Well, that's the hangar I was talking about in World War II. They were doing the back engineering. Okay, they're already in that business. And so along comes the Roswell case, and that's where the physical evidence went. That's where it went, Hangar 23. So how does it become Hangar 18? Well, down in Florida, you know, a lot of military people retire to Florida, especially from the East Coast. And on the West Coast, they go to Sedona, Arizona, or San Antonio, Texas. But on the East Coast, they would go to Florida oftentimes. And there was a fellow down there named Professor Robert Spencer Carr. He was no professor. He gave himself that appellation, professor. But he started talking about, this is like in 1974, and I remember this because it made national news. He started talking about this Hangar 18 at Wright-Patterson, where all of the bodies, the alien bodies, were stored. Now, where did he get those stories? He got them from the retirees that had worked at Wright-Patterson, retired to Florida. They knew he was already in the flying saucer business by giving talks. So they would come up to him afterwards and say, "Well, you know, Professor, I worked at Hangar 18 in Wright-Patterson, and that's where they had all the wreckage and the bodies and all that sort of stuff." So that's where the story of Hangar 18 got started, okay, by Professor Robert Spencer Carr. So how does Hangar 23 become Hangar 18? Well, out of, you know, people are always using short you know, when you short something up or something is more convenient. Well, you have all these buildings, building 18s in this complex. Well, to them, it was Hangar 18. That was the only hangar in the building 18 complex. And so they would call it Hangar 18 out of convenience. But it's really Hangar 23 because that's where all the back engineering took place. So that's the story of how Hangar 18 got its name. It's really Hangar 23. And that took a lot of work. But piecing the story together from Professor Robert Spencer Carr in Florida, getting all these little stories from retirees that had worked there. So he starts talking about it, and it was picked up by the mainstream news. And the reason I remember that is I was on my way to Toronto to continue my anthropology studies. And I heard this story on the radio, and I said, oh, my goodness, I want to stay here and listen to this. But I had to catch a flight to Toronto to start my doctorate studies. But by the time I got to Toronto, the story was dead. And it wasn't until, that was 1974. So it wasn't until 78 when Jesse Marcel, the base intelligence officer, went public with Stanton Friedman and William Moore. And they wrote the 1980 book, The Roswell Incident, which when I read it, it just blew me away. For as far as UFOs are concerned, I said, oh, there's nothing like this story. And I became active in 1991 with Don Schmidt and Kevin Randall. I joined their team in 91. And Don Schmidt and I have been a team together since 1998. So that's a long time for one case, right? But I just found that it was so compelling. And every time we found a new witness, it just was like a recharge of your batteries. Boom, we got it. Let's go for more. And so here we are, 12 books later. And there's the way we look at it, there's nothing more to really do for us other than to, you know, try to, if something comes across our desk, you know, we'll look at it, but we're not out there, you know, as they say, pounding the pavement to find new witnesses because they're all gone. They're all gone. So we're hoping for a piece of physical evidence will turn up. We know they're out there. We hope that it turns up somewhere, or less likely the Air Force or the military in their next report will come clean. And we're not expecting that, but, that's where we're at right now, Kelly.
Well, speaking of physical evidence, for me, one of the revelations in your book that honestly about knocked me out of my chair had to do with that memory medal that you were talking about earlier that you and your co-author dubbed the Holy Grail of Roswell. So this is something that has an absolutely legendary status within the UFO community. But what was really shocking for me was that it seems like you guys were able to track down, you know, short of actually holding it in your hand, a smoking, as close as you can get to a smoking gun, that this metal actually exists. So could you talk about that a little bit?
Yes, there are right now two smoking guns for the Roswell incident. One is the telex that General Ramey is holding in his hand the day that the case was announced in the newspaper in 1947. He's holding a memo that he just received from Washington. And somebody, a press person, took a picture of him kneeling by this weather balloon, which he was putting out the weather balloon story. And in this memo, with today's photographic programs, we could actually read parts of the memo. And it's talking about victims of the wreck. Well, there's no weather balloon that where you have a victim. Even if it lands on your head, you're not a victim. Victims of the wreck, and it mentions DISK, D-I-S-K in parentheses. And so that's one smoking gun because it's talking about not a crash of a weather balloon, but the UFO, the disc, the flying saucer. The second smoking gun, what we call the memory mill, that's what they were most interested in the wreckage. You had a, you know, you had the very stiff wreckage, which, you know, couldn't bend at all. But this memory mill, there was a lot of it in the crash scene. And you can pick it up, it's very light. You would wad it up in your hand. It felt like you had nothing in your hand. Open your hand, it would just float around there. And you couldn't cut it, scratch it, do anything to it. And so our associate, who I mentioned previously, he took it upon himself. He wanted to know whatever became of the wreckage, whatever became of the wreckage. So he, of course, started with Wright Patterson, because we know that's where it went. And so he somehow, I think he sent Freedom of Information Act requests to the Defense Department and to Wright Patterson, got nowhere. But somehow he latched on to this. He also, Battelle Memorial Institute in Columbus, Ohio. That's where Wright Patterson, when they had a project that involved material and something, they would send it to Battelle to analyze. So he found out that the wreckage went to Battelle Memorial Institute in Columbus, Ohio. And he kept digging around. And, we didn't have anything. Well, he actually found out from the Department of Defense that they did have something at Battelle. Yes, you're right. We found it. But first they told him to get lost. But he got at least four progress reports on the project to back engineer this memory metal. And Battelle, they wanted nothing to do with UFOs. They said, you know, if we ever make a report on this, don't use our name. We don't want our name associated with anything to do with UFOs. So they laundered the discovery of, it was made out of mostly titanium, this memory metal, and some other known element that they could, we got the information also from the base commander. He said it was titanium and some other element he couldn't remember. So what Battelle did is they laundered it through the Naval Ordnance Lab in Maryland. So in 1962, the Naval Ordnance Laboratory in Maryland, they announced the discovery or the creation of this new amalgam called nitinol. It's spelled N-I-T-I-O-L. N-I stands for nickel, T-I stands for titanium, and N-O-L stands for Naval Ordnance Lab. Battelle did the work, but they laundered the results through the Naval Ordnance Lab so they wouldn't be associated with UFOs. So you can look up nitinol in your browser. You can buy it by the coil. You can buy it by the roll. You can buy it by the sheet. But its origins came from the Roswell crash of 1947, the memory metal. It tries to mimic the memory metal, which it does, with one exception, you can cut it, but the original you can't. The original you can't deform it in any way. But this nitinol does everything. You can. They use it in your eyeglass frames, anything that requires shape recovery. Nitinol, and it comes from Battelle that did the work on it. It's a combination of titanium and nickel. They did all. So our associate has four progress reports of this project. And it was an amazing piece of research. And there's no doubt because they were trying to re-engineer the memory model. We also have a fellow that was from Lawrence Livermore Labs. This is another government laboratory in California, Livermore, California. They sent some material out there. They didn't tell them where it came from, but hey, take a look at this, see what it's made out of, and tell us. And he contacted me. He says, yeah, I kept a piece of it. And he sent me a piece of it that I have a picture of it in my computer. He says, but on the promise that I never give his name or send a picture to anybody. So that's sort of a tease, but I have a picture of it in my computer, and it is silvery looking, but that's the best. Well, it's a smoking gun. It's a smoking gun because you can trace, you can trace this piece of memory metal into Nitinol from the crash site to Roswell Army Air Field, to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, to Battelle Memorial Institute in Columbus, Ohio, to the Naval Ordnance Lab, who announced the quote-unquote discovery.
Oh, that is just astonishing. I mean, there's so much in this book that really bowled me over, but of all of it, to me, that was...
That's a smoking gun, too.
No, not at all. I think that's the most interesting thing in the whole book. Like, it's a fantastic book, but I was really blown away by that.
Put Nitinol in your browser and you'll see what comes up. That's our best effort of trying to re-engineer the Roswell memory metal. It's used in the space program. Whenever they need their shape recovery, something recovery, they use Nitinol. So
that's so cool. Well, obviously, one of the other most tantalizing aspects of the lore surrounding Wright-Patterson Air Force Base is, you know, as we've mentioned, that there are potentially the bodies of the beings who are flying the craft that were taken to the base for storage and examination. And it's really striking how similar the descriptions are that people give of the beings that they claim to have seen. So can you talk a little bit about what these beings looked like? Because it seems like everyone was sort of giving you almost the same description.
Yes. This is one of the interesting things, is that anybody that ever gave us what did they look like? They give us very similar description. 3.5 to 4 feet tall, frail body, maybe 35 pounds, long arms that go down to the knees. But the oversized head is the salient feature, is the oversized head and the frail, diminutive body. Gray in color, usually, but sometimes you have different colors described. It could have been dependent upon the state of decay of a body when it decays, maybe, you know, or the lighting conditions it was seen under. But it's gray. Also, the head, the nose is just two holes in the front of the face, not a nose. You don't have a nose, no nose, but just two holes. The mouth is a slit that doesn't go anywhere. You know, our mouth leads to our digestive tract. Well, this mouth just had a little cavity in there, and it didn't go anywhere. And the ears, again, no ears, but just two little holes in the side of the head, and hairless, totally hairless. So we have descriptions in the book you read, and we have drawings from the actual witnesses who had seen them, and they all resemble the same creature, So. I guess today you would call them grays. They would be similar to grays. Small in stature, frail, but with the oversized pear-shaped head. Pear-shaped head. So the witnesses have been consistent on that. And there was one.
Yeah, it would seem very consistent. Alive. Yeah, that was one of kind of the saddest parts of the book. Maybe that's me being a little too naive, but it was really sad to know that there was, if you could talk a little bit about the one that survived and what happened to it.
Yes, everyone that was out cleaning up the crash site who saw the bodies always said there were three or four, but one was still alive. And we have two stories from witnesses that interacted with it. And the first one was from we got from the daughter of a fireman by the name of Dan Dwyer. He was a fireman with one of a thousand names. Dan Dwyer was a fireman with the Roswell City Fire Department. And the city manager, when the crash was discovered, when they learned of the crash, went to the fire department in town, said, don't go out. The military will take care of it. The military will take care of it. So don't go out to the crash site. So Dan Dwyer said, hell with that. So he got into his own car and went out himself because he wanted to, you know, see what was going on there. So he went out there and he said, oh my goodness, his eyes were focused on, there were two dead that were sort of hanging out of the craft. He says his eyes were focused on the two dead ones. And all of a sudden he saw movement out of the corner of his eyes. And he looked over and here one of them, like I just described to you, was walking around. So we get the story from his daughter because he was dead he was already dead. So he gets home that night and, you know, his wife, what did you do today, dear? And he says, well, we had a crash of a flying saucer, as they called them back then, north of town. And, well, were there any beings in it? Oh, yes, there were three. Two dead and one alive. What did it look like? Well, he didn't give them the description I just gave you. According to Frankie Rowe, his daughter, Frankie Dwyer Rowe, all he said was child of the earth. Child of the earth. I'm thinking, what is that? Well, child of the earth is a land, it's like a land scorpion, but it's like a large insect. That the reason they call it the child of the earth, because it has this oval shaped head, pinkish face with a description like I just gave you for the alien. And they call it a child because when a newborn child is born, the phones, yeah, this is what happens when you get old. The bones in the head haven't fused yet. And where they haven't fused is a dark line. So the top of the head of this child of the earth has these dark markings on the top of its head. And that's why they call it a child of the earth. Well, that's what this being had. On the top of its head, it had these markings. And that's why he called it the child of the earth. Well, did you talk to it? Yes. We talked to one another. Well, what did you talk about? Well, we didn't talk like we're talking now with, like we talk using our mouth and lips and tongue. We talked in our heads. He said, we talked in our heads, like, you know, mental telepathy, I guess is what we would call it. But we talked in our heads. Well, what did you talk about? They're giving him the third degree. Well, I was worried about it. You know, with this creature walking around, but before I could say anything, the creature told me in my head, don't worry about me. My ship is destroyed. My comrades are dead, or whatever term he used for comrades. And there's nothing anybody can do. I accept my fate. There's nothing anybody can do. I accept my fate. I'm sort of stuck here. And at that point, the military came up and they took over the site. And grabbed the Dan Dwyer and told him, don't ever talk about this. We'll kill you and we'll kill your family. But that's what the conversation was. The creature was more concerned about Dan Dwyer were equally concerned about, as Dan Dwyer was concerned about it. So that's the first story we have. The second one involves an officer, a Marine pilot during World War II, but he was in the Air War College in Montgomery, Alabama in 1947-48. One of 90 officers, you know, they're considered, these officers are going to take us into the 20th century and the blah, blah, 21st century. So he's a high-ranking lieutenant colonel. They're flown to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in the spring of 1948. Spring of 1948. This is like 6 months after the crash. So they're, because they're going to learn how to be administrators of bases and stuff like that. So this one day, we're taken into this hangar, Hangar 23. And so there's about 60 of them. What are we doing in here? You know, so they roll out all of this wreckage, this strange wreckage from the Roswell crash. Okay, fellas, take a look at this stuff. Tell us what you think. Because the Air Force at this point, they don't know how, you know, should we tell the people? Should we keep it secret? What, you know, we're still in a state of flux as to what to do with this event. So they look, they're looking at this. And not everybody had heard of the Roswell crash. Roswell is a two-day story back in 1947, 2 days. Not everybody heard about it. So they're saying, what is this stuff? You know, they got the memory. And so they said, where did you get this? And they said, we got it from the crash of a flying saucer last year in New Mexico. That's what they told them. Oh, that's great. What's a flying saucer? You know, so they're scratching their heads. So they said, follow me. And they went into another room, windowless, except they had a big mirror where on the other side it's a mirror, but on the side that the officers were at, you could see through into the next room. So they go in there and they're looking through this window pane, and lo and behold, there's the live one. Now, I don't know if it was sitting, standing, doing push-ups, or doing the Macarena. I don't know what it was doing. He didn't say. But our officer, we got the story from his son. The officer's he's looking through there, and the son said, "Dad, did you talk to it?" And he said, "No, but I had a mental connection with it. I felt great sympathy for it. But no, we did not converse. Other than that, he said, I felt its human qualities rather than its alien qualities." So this was a thing going back between the two of them. And this officer, he fell out of favor with his next higher up officer. And you know, when that happens, your future in the whatever branch of the service you're in is sort of stuck. So he got out of the Marine Corps and he founded a McDonald's restaurant in the Colorado. And my understanding was he had all of the McDonald's west of the Mississippi. So he wasn't hurting for money or any notoriety, but that's the story we got from his son. And he was a decorated fighter pilot, night fighter pilot in the Pacific Theater of Operations of World War II. He looked like Tyrone Power. I thought he could have been like a movie star or something. He looked just like Tyrone Power, but he founded a McDonald's franchise, and then one after the other. And he died in 1997, which was the 50th anniversary of the Roswell incident. So that's what we know about the alien bodies or creatures. That they called them creatures or little people or stuff like that, but they didn't call them aliens. And that's our best guess, is the five of them now. Oh, and this the other thing was, the son asked his father, he said, what happened to it? And he said, they killed it. Well, what do you mean? Did they stand it up against the wall like the St. Valentine's Day Massacre and kill it? No. They were doing some experiment on it, and it died in whatever experiment they were working on. So the suggestion is, if you could converse with this live one, at least mentally, they must have learned a lot of things, you would think. But that's just a surmise. And of course, they've never come clean on the Roswell case, so we don't know about this. That's why, you know, after this May 22nd thing last year, there was a lot of negative feeling about what took place, which was like a dog and pony show. But they're supposed to go back to at least 1947 or 45 on their next report. So people like me, who worked on the case, and others who are interested in the case, want to know if they're going to address the Roswell case. And we're not talking about a weather balloon. We're not talking about a high altitude Project Mogul, which falls apart like a cheap suit when you look at it. We want to see what they say about Roswell, if anything. And if they don't say anything, we know why. There's too much there for the Roswell case. It's the best case ever. Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, I feel like we could go dive into this book forever. I know we're running short on time, but there was one more question that I really wanted to ask you. Because I think one of the most striking things about the UFO phenomenon and about, you know, the stories of Roswell and at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in particular, there's sort of this repeating theme where all of this information is classified and in some places even above the Oval Office. So we have, you know, secrets. We have the indication that there are secrets that our government is keeping that even the president doesn't have access to, which I think is really unsettling for those of us who have been told that we live in a democracy. And so what do you make of the fact that we have this secret that we have been keeping for so long, seemingly away from any kind of meaningful oversight?
There's two answers to that. Number one, if you're in the government, if you're in the military, mostly you want to get to the next grade. You're not going to get to the next grade. If you're a full-bird colonel and you want to make general, you're not going to go to your commanding officers, who is at least a one-star general or two-star or what have you. Hey, general, what about that Roswell case? That's not going to get you your next promotion. So you already know what the official Air Force or military position is on Roswell. And it's that it was a high altitude Project Mogul balloon array back in 1947 that was designed as part of a project to listen in on what they expected to be the initial Soviet atomic bomb test. That's what it was designed to zero in on, listen for the, because up in the upper atmosphere, there's a layer of the atmosphere where it carries sound. The idea was to lift the balloon up there with a microphone to listen in for the sound of a Soviet detonation of its first atomic device. That's the official Air Force position. That's what the Roswell crash was. And that the bodies, this is even wilder, the bodies were dime store mannequins that they used in 10 years later in high altitude parachute drops in case a high altitude aircraft that they were building, like the U-2, in case you had to abandon ship, what the effect would be from parachuting from high altitude. And that's what they say, what the bodies, people reporting the little bodies were. The problem was these mannequins were 6 foot. They looked human. They were dressed in flight suits. And when they hit the ground, they came all apart. That's not what the witnesses described. But that's the military, the Air Force position today. So you already know that. And if you want to get your next promotion, you're not going to be talking about this. So that's one reason. The other reason is all of the stuff now is in private hands. All of the wreckage is in private hands. So they don't have to respond to Freedom of Information Act requests. And I believe presidents and political people in general, they don't want to have their name near the term UFO. They don't want to have their name. Look at the congressman from Ohio. I can't remember his name. A couple of years ago, ran for president. But he had already made statements about UFOs and that he thought there was. And as soon as the press started asking him about UFOs, he went like this in the polls, you know.
Kucinich, yeah.
Dennis Kucinich, yes. That's right. Thank you.
Mm.
That was his death knell when he started talking about, yes, I saw a UFO. Jimmy Carter actually reported seeing a UFO. He reported it to, I don't know if it was MUFON or NICAP or one of the groups. And it did. I don't think it hurt him because he was only he was a one-term president, so I don't know. But political people, they don't want to know. They don't want to know. Now, they ask, I think George H.W. Bush, Herbert Walker Bush, knew because he was a head of the CIA at one point. He was a ambassador to the UN and a president. There's no doubt in my mind he knew, and his son, George W., there's no doubt in my mind that he knows, too. Clinton, I believe, knows, but he says, well, I wanted to know, and wouldn't tell me anything, and blah, blah, blah. You know, he sort of waffled all over the place. I believe Obama, when they asked Obama, he just laughed. I think he knows something. Because he would say, oh, well, you know, I wouldn't be surprised or something like that, you know, trying to deflect. And Trump, there's no doubt in my mind, when his son asked him one day, and it was videotaped, Dad, well, what do you think about Roswell? Well, I've heard some very interesting things about Roswell. Well, so do you believe in UFOs? Not particularly. I'm thinking, what is he talking about? On one hand, he says he's heard some very interesting things about Roswell. Then his son says, well, so how about UFO? No, I don't believe in this guy. He knows. And
yeah.
So it's the other thing, Kelly, is you've heard of compartmentalization. One, they will give you a project, but they want you to be focused solely on one aspect of it. They don't want you to know what it's connected to, that's the military way, is compartmentalization. And a lot of times they don't know because it's been compartmentalized. And to go along with that, they don't want to know. They don't want to know because they don't want to be asked, well, I understand that you were involved in this UFO project. Well, that's there goes Dennis Kucinich, you know. So they don't want to know. But most people, you know, the way things are, especially with those videos that came out in 2019 from Elizondo, that everybody's seen 1,000 times. There's no other explanation for those. They're trying to waffle and say, oh, well, it's a UAP, unidentified aerial phenomenon. No, it's a UFO. So they changed the terminology from UFO to UAP, which covers a lot of things. And that's where they dump UFOs. It's a joke. It's a joke. But like I said, I know what I know about Roswell. There's some other good cases. I say, you know, they're good cases, but I know they've had the stuff since 1947, and I don't know how they can say, well, we don't have any physical evidence. Well, then if they're saying that, they just don't know. They, you know, they don't know about Roswell and they don't want to know. So.
So true. Well, Tom, thank you so much for being here today, for having this conversation. Thank you for your decades of work on these cases. I can't wait to read more of your books.
We have 12.
I've got some work to do. I will put links to all of that in the episode description for anyone who would like to find out more and read more. But thank you so much for your time today. This has been a wonderful conversation.
Well, I hope I didn't get too far down into the weeds. For your audience, it's tough when you have all these little factoids. It's tough to summarize sometimes, and I hope I did impart the best overview that I can to your audience.
Oh, you did. It was wonderful. I'm sure you've forgotten more about this than most people ever knew. So thank you for sharing your all of your expertise.
Thank you, Kelly. It's been nice to be with you.